Governor Cuomo says churches can't meet in groups over 10 in New York, but the Supreme Court said, not in our house. Apparently, churches can now say they are on the same plane as liquor stores, pet shops, and law offices. Yeah, there's a lawyer joke there somewhere. I just can't bill for it, so I'm done looking. And the Supreme Court hears arguments about whether their decision that unanimous jury verdicts are required by the Sixth Amendment is applicable to people previously convicted. It would kind of suck to be living the Shawshank experience only to find out they changed the rules and you should be a free person. Eh, oh well. Cookies crumble. And finally, legal troubles have hit the Housewives of Beverly Hills. And I'm not talking about suing those responsible for the balloon lips. Mackenzie and I unpack all of these issues in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Well, welcome to this week's Debriefing of the Law. I am Joel Oster, your host, and Mackenzie, welcome again.
Thanks for having me again.
A lot has happened this week. It seems like this week just zoomed by with all the incredible news. We have a lot to unpack. Now, I do want to just pause here to say, I've been doing these daily updates every day. They're on YouTube. They're on Facebook. It's just a couple of minutes, 2 to 3 minutes, and they're short because I have a short attention span, and so they're just a few minutes, and I bring you the headline stories from the previous day with a heavy emphasis on the legal news. But of course, since absolutely everything in life touches the law in some way, I got a lot to choose from. And so the reason why I like doing these daily headlines, Mackenzie, is it gives me some material to talk to you about at the end of the week. So we have a lot to choose from. It's been an incredible week. And so let's dig right in. The Supreme Court was in session this week, and they had a full week, which means they only heard argument on 3 days. And so I thought, Mackenzie, it might be interesting if we start with a little bit of Supreme Court trivia. Now, I know I'm putting you on the spot just a little bit. I sent you the questions ahead of time, but I didn't give you the answer. So I know, I'm pretty sure you didn't actually Google these because you had work to do. But nonetheless, let's just start off with a little bit of Supreme Court trivia. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. On average, how many cases does the Supreme Court hear in a year? I mean, we know that this week they had a full week of argument, which meant that Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, they heard 2 cases each day. Actually, I think maybe just 1 case on one of those days. But nonetheless, that's a full week's worth of work for them. On average, every year, how many cases? By the way, I believe 7,000 cert petitions are filed every year. How many cases does the Supreme Court hear?
And we're talking about like merits cases that are heard on argument days, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
So my guess, and you're right, I did not Google these because I had a very busy day. So my guess will be 40. I will guess 80.
80. All right. That actually hit the nail on the head. 70 to 80, which is down. Oh, yeah. You
see, you I'm one for one.
That's right. You're not doing too bad. And this court is probably the least worked court in the history of the Supreme Court. I've been following the numbers, and they were like up around 200, then 150, then 100. Now they're down to 70. Yeah, pretty soon they're just going to decide 1 case a year, then just go out and play golf. I don't know. But nonetheless, does that surprise you? Only 70 cases a year?
Well, you know, it doesn't. And I'll tell you why. Because there's so much briefing and amicus briefing and so much paper that goes into every single case that they have to make their way through and get through, that it's really, when you listen to oral argument on the 3 argument days a week when they're in term, it's really just the tip of the iceberg. And it doesn't surprise me either that they are hearing fewer cases now than in the past, because I feel like the opinions are getting much longer term over term.
Right.
And I feel like the reason is just because there's more precedent. Like, we live in a common law country where like a lot of these cases are based on cases that came before and what the court did. And it gets me to thinking, like, back in the John Marshall days, what did they even write about? Like, they didn't have any precedent where they just, like, it was a blank page and they were, like, denied. Like, there was nothing.
Right,
just make it up. But now, you know, you think about, for example, the infamous Citizens United case when they were talking about, oh, this overturns 100 years of precedent. And here are all the cases that, you know, this is kind of overturning. So, you know, it doesn't surprise me. I think they do a lot of work and I don't envy their, you know, work burden or work schedule at all, for sure.
Well,
although they do
like
have clerks to help out.
Exactly. They are the best and the brightest. But like you said, they set precedent. So they don't just take cases where the lower court messed up. I believe Scalia once said, we don't care about errors. We're not a court of errors. We're not here to fix errors that the lower court made. Instead, how you get a case to the Supreme Court, the kind of cases they're looking for are cases where the various circuits are in conflict. So if the First Circuit rendered an opinion on that matter that conflicts with the 11th Circuit, or the State Supreme Court in Mississippi issued a ruling that contradicts the 11th Circuit, things like that. They look for circuit splits. They just don't simply take a case because the lower court got it wrong. And so, yeah, they're not going to take that many cases, only about 70 to 80 per year. All right. Also, we heard recently in the news about court packing. Now, I think this is going to go away really quickly. I think that was just a political issue to motivate people or scare people on the Amy Coney Barrett. Whatever. I don't actually think, unless something happens to Biden and he has to leave the White House, court packing is not going to happen. That being said, there are 9 justices. Now, Mackenzie, I know this does not surprise you. You know this. The U.S. Constitution does not limit or set the number of Supreme Court justices, right? You were aware of that?
I was.
So, do you know the fewest number of justices that we have had at the U.S. Supreme Court that were allowed?
That were allowed. I think they started out back in the early days with 6, if I'm not mistaken. So, I'm going to go with 6.
6 was the starting number?
You're going to go with 6? I'll just go with 6, yeah.
All right. This might be a trick question, so I don't know. I tried to catch myself in how I asked it. And so I do believe, the correct answer is 6 has been the fewest number of justices, but, and this is a huge but, I believe 5 is the number of that has been the fewest amount of justices set by Congress. Here's what I'm talking about. The original number, as you said, was 6. What happened in the third election? Adams lost to Jefferson, and we're talking about 2 different political factions going head-to-head. Jefferson was a Democrat. Adams was a Federalist, and the Federalists lost. Well, as he was leaving, he just wanted to stick it to his opponents. And so they passed this law that changed the number of justices from 6 to 5. That way, the new administration, when one justice would step down or leave office, they could not replace that justice because the number had then been changed from 6 to 5. Now, I'm not sure that a justice ever left. So I don't think it actually got to 5, but they changed the law to allow that to happen. Also, care for history's sake, that was the same law, the Midnight Justices, that resulted in Marbury v. Madison, the lawsuit. That was that whole issue right there. Because also, in addition to changing the number of justices from 6 to 5, they also created a lot of new judicial positions there in D.C. and created new district courts as well. All right, let's move
on. Everyone was so vindictive back in the day. You know, we think it's bad now. And it is. Like, I'm not saying it's not, but, you know, you go back a couple hundred years and people were just, you know, stabbing each other in the back all the time.
Oh, look at your history books. I mean, Washington was our president for 8 years and everyone was in agreement. He stood 6'2", was a giant. He looked like an amazing king. Everyone loved George. But then when he decided not to run again, yeah. You had the 2-party system, all hell broke loose, and we have been fighting ever since. People say, oh, it started with Trump. No. It started way back when. All right, well, you already got my next one. The starting number was 6. What has been the highest number of justices?
I have no idea, but I know that FDR tried to pack the court, and
right?
I think he was going to make it. I'm probably going too high here, but was he going to make it 15?
That's what the number that sticks in my head. And I really thought the answer here was 15. I went digging through my history books, couldn't find it. The highest number I found was 10. So, listeners, if you actually know the answer to this one, let me know. I did some research today, and my research showed me 10 was the highest number of justices that have ever served on the Supreme Court. All right. This one I know you're going to get wrong unless you actually paid attention in my class, because listeners, Mackenzie and I actually met when she attended one of my classes. I teach CLEs. A question I always...
In my defense, it was a year ago, so, you know...
You know what, Mackenzie? I'll just let you know. I am allowed to go back to Pennsylvania and tell them we were wrong. She actually did not attend that hour. She wasn't listening. And so we're going to resend your credit depending upon your answer to this question.
License right. revoked. Okay.
That's
my
right.
entire career is riding on this.
Oh, Mackenzie, you would not even begin to understand. Oh, the stories that we have heard from lawyers. It's head scratching. Oh, they're idiots out there.
Yeah.
I mean... I think the CLE process should also be a minimum guide of competency for lawyers. If you can't figure out how to manage the nuances of signing up for a CLE class, a continuing legal education class, you know, if you don't have that minimum level of computer competence, you really shouldn't be representing people in court. Now, that's just my take, but I'm going to move on here. All right, here you go, Mackenzie. How long does a Supreme Court justice serve? How long is his or her tenure in office?
What
is your answer?
Their whole life.
You think it's for life?
Yeah.
Is that your final answer? Do you want to call someone? Do you have a friend, maybe a lifeline you want to reach out to, or is that your final answer?
Does it say something like until they retire, die, or get impeached? I know it's a lifetime tenure, so I'm going with life, whatever.
Oh my goodness, Mackenzie, you are off. I am so sorry. You are no longer a practicing lawyer. No, the actual answer in the Constitution, because I know many of our listeners are also screaming, it's for life. I just watched the Amy Coney Barrett. I know it's for life. That's what they said, life appointments. No, the actual Constitution says they shall hold their offices during periods of good behavior. As long as they're not misbehaving, they can keep their job. But if they start misbehaving, they start acting out, they are kicked out. And it actually does not say for life. It just says as long as they are not misbehaving.
Well, that must be interpreted very broadly, because I know that Antonin Scalia shot Dick Cheney in the neck with a shotgun, and he kept serving on that Supreme Court. So I want to see the case law on this.
Exactly. You think, wait a second. But now you know, Mackenzie, why they don't like the proceedings to be televised. Because I'm telling you, no one recognizes them. I do these man on the street interviews where I show people a picture of a Supreme Court justice. I'll show them 9, 10 of them, whatever. They have no idea who these guys are, except for one. Who do you think is the one, and I'm only one justice, that they recognized?
Well, now they probably recognize Brett Kavanaugh, and maybe
nope.
Amy Coney Barrett.
You showed Brett Kavanaugh's picture? They didn't
really?
Recognize him. Nope, did not recognize him.
You should.
I'm telling you, only one. You pick it.
Well, it has to be RBG then.
RBG. I'm telling you, about 80%, almost everyone recognized RBG as Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Even Clarence Thomas, they had no idea. That shocked me. But nonetheless, now you know why they don't televise. No one recognizes. So when they see them drinking at the bar down the street, no one has any idea they sit on the high court. All right. Well, that leads to my last question. In the history of the United States Supreme Court, how many justices have been impeached? So if we know that they can be removed, you know, if they are misbehaving, how many have been impeached?
I don't know. I seem to remember that Samuel Chase was impeached in the early days, but I feel like there might have been someone else. I know it's very few.
You nailed it. Samuel Chase is the only justice to have ever been impeached. That was a political impeachment. If you look it up, not really based on anything that he did. They actually based it on his opinions and his actions as a judge below the Supreme Court. But nonetheless, he wasn't convicted by the Senate. That means in the entire history of our nation, not one single justice has ever misbehaved. Quite an impressive record. I bet you if you go to the kitchen there at the Supreme Court building, they probably have a sign up in there on the wall there at the kitchen that says, 82,000 days and no behavior accidents. Don't you be the first. Behavior is job one. All right. Well, you did a really good job there with our trivia. Feel free to try to stump me on any given week. All right. Let's move on now to our big case from this last week. I know this is a case you and I talked about. It's a fascinating case because it deals with what we are dealing with now every single day of our lives, right? You cannot get free from COVID, restrictions. I assume today, Mackenzie, you wore a mask. Is that right?
I did.
Yeah. You know what I just realized? I didn't. I went through an entire day. I never left my house. All right. Well, nonetheless, we deal with these restrictions every single day. And it's Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn, New York, the Cuomo. This is the case where Governor Cuomo created various restrictions on businesses and essential businesses. They had a certain number of restrictions. Non-essential businesses had more serious restrictions. And most particular in this case, if you were a church and you were in a red zone, which must have been some zone that they figured that the infection rate was inordinately high, that a church could not meet with more than 10 people. Now, here's the deal, Mackenzie. It didn't matter how big the church was. The church could be an auditorium that seated 10 people or 200,000 people. It did not matter. The maximum occupancy of a church in a red zone was 10 people. There also were some orange zones. Must have been a little bit lesser infection rate in those zones. And that limit was 25 people. If you were a non-essential business, if you were an essential business, then it was basically no limits. And so those were the facts of that case. Mackenzie, what are your thoughts about these COVID restrictions and how the law applies to it? Do you think Cuomo messed up here?
I do. I mean, I think, you know, when obviously the states have a wide police power when it comes to public safety, and I guess public health is a part of that. And, you know, obviously there are thousands of people dying of this disease in the United States every day.
Right.
So there is a compelling government interest here. There's a compelling government interest and a compelling, you know, public health interest. But when we're talking about religious freedom, and you're the expert here, not me, but I remember from way back in the day, when we're talking about a First Amendment right to free exercise of religion, the restriction on that exercise has to be narrowly tailored. And like you just mentioned, it just seems like, you know, it was kind of arbitrary here. There made no mention of whether it was a church or a place of worship with one tiny room or like the hugest cathedral in New York. And that actually really matters in terms of, you know, transmissibility of this virus. And there was no distinction made in the law. So I don't think it was narrowly tailored. And I think, you know, there's a lot of examples of COVID restrictions in place that are similarly arbitrary. And, you know, in most cases, I think they're issued and promulgated in good faith, but it's such kind of like an emergent situation that people don't really have time. They're not thinking it through.
Well, let's back up here, because you threw a lot of really important concepts. You threw out the concept of this is a church, but a lot of us, we're not churches. We're just normal Joe and Nancy, right? Living our lives. And a lot of us say, you know what? I don't like these restrictions. I mean, this is the land of the free. We have a freedom, and we don't really, it's hard for us to understand. So the government can come in and just take my freedom away? I thought that, I mean, where do you draw that line? And you just said, no, government can do that in the name of fighting against some kind of disease or in public health. But surely there's some kind of line to be drawn. I mean, how would a non-lawyer even compute that those two opposite ideas of we have freedom, but yeah, the government can come in and take that freedom away whenever they want to?
You know, I think most adults alive today remember the Patriot Act and the wireless wiretap
right.
laws and all of that stuff that happened in the wake of September 11th. And, you know, if you're a student of history, you know about the internments that happened during World War II and, you know, even Abraham Lincoln suspending habeas corpus during the Civil War. Like, every time there is a crisis, an emergency, whether it be a foreign invasion or otherwise, like, civil unrest or, you know, in this case, a pandemic, there's going to be a government response. And I think all of us would agree that, you know, we want our government to protect us. We want it to do something. But also, you know, we're very clear in the United States that we are willing to pay a fairly high price for our freedom. And I think if you look, I mean, China obviously is an egregious example, but when this virus right. started, you saw footage of people being welded into their homes. And, you know, I mean, who knows the accuracy wow. of their numbers now, but it seems like they've really stopped transmission, or at least really, really cut down transmission of this disease, if their numbers are accurate. But the price that they're, I mean, they don't have the internet. Like, there's a right, there's right. a lot, a huge price that their citizens pay for that type of government control. And I think, you know, the average American might not know the nuances of what is strict scrutiny versus intermediate scrutiny, but we do know that we kind of err on the side of freedom, or at least ideally we would want to.
Right. So I think it's fair to say that the government, in the name of an emergency situation where a pandemic is afoot, right? Something like that. The government can make some rulings that for the public good. Now, how far they can go, it's going to be very limited. I mean, as a lawyer, we're first trained to say, okay, are you picking and choosing who is subject to these restrictions and who is not? And obviously that's going to be an easy way to litigate this case. But let's just say the government did not pick and choose. They just did a blanket. Everyone stay in your house, lock your door. All right. I don't think that's going to be, that hasn't happened in our history. I don't think it's ever going to happen. And if it did happen, people would just ignore it and we would revolt. That's just not something you could do to the American people. So let's set that aside as being nonsensical. Then the next thing you're going to be confronted with is, okay, the government is only shutting down some people. Right. So how do we draw that line? Well, there is this idea, two ideas that run throughout our law. The first idea is that the government cannot infringe on your fundamental rights. So free speech, free exercise of religion, right to associate, right to petition your government for a redress of grievances, equal protection, non-discrimination under law, all of these things like that. The government cannot infringe upon those fundamental rights unless they have a really good reason for doing so. Now, you threw out some terms like narrow tailoring, compelling governmental interest. That's legal speak for the government has to have a really good reason. And the means that they go about restricting your rights has to be the most narrowly tailored approach to resolving that issue. And so let's look at the actual facts of this case. What do you think about this distinction of essential businesses? You know, they said that, you know, like a pet shop is an essential business, a grocery store is an essential business, a lawyer's office is an essential business, but a church isn't. Well, what are your thoughts about that?
You know, that's where I think the governor started to go awry here, because I do understand, and I think it was Justice Sotomayor who pointed out, you know, that there are some differences between a place of like a religious service, which typically lasts, you know, maybe an hour, in some cases several hours, and people are together in a room, sometimes singing or at least right. speaking, and they're in right. an enclosed space for a prolonged period of time, which we know is like the riskiest type of behavior. Whereas in a grocery store, you can kind of go in, get what you need, and leave, and that therefore it's much, much less risky than staying in an enclosed area for a period of time. However,
I just got to add this right here, because I got to tell you, when I heard that from the court, my first thought was, Have you ever been to a church? Because I'm telling you, most of the churches that I have been to, you got to wave your hands in the middle of the service so that the lights don't go off because they're motion activated, right? There's been no movement, no one singing. We're all like, as quiet as could be. It was actually kind of a running joke in the church that I was brought up in that we all just kind of sat on our hands. No one's going to raise their hand, right? That's too much show of emotion. But I get you. Theoretically, in churches, people are singing and they're singing out loud.
Correct. However, you know, the definition of what is an essential business, I mean, you can just cut the corruption with a knife. I mean, you can actually almost hear the desperate cries of lobbyists telling the governor, like, what my, you know, industry is an essential business. And that's like, look, I am a lawyer. And I do understand in some cases, for example, if you are a criminal defense attorney and you have an incarcerated client who doesn't have access to Zoom, like, you have to go and meet with that person in person. And criminal defendants especially have a lot of constitutional rights that must be protected. However, like in my line of work, and I do civil litigation, like we don't, I mean, we've been doing Zoom depositions, Zoom hearings, Zoom, there are Zoom trials that are going on in some jurisdictions. So it's completely unnecessary to be in person. It's a burden. Sure. Of course, like it's much better to meet in person for like a prep session for a deposition or something like that. It's much more effective in person, but we can make do in the name of public safety, and that's what we've all been trying to do. So I think that's really where the governor kind of started to go awry here, and I do think that there's just, I don't want to say a knee-jerk response because I don't want to, I'm not trying to be pejorative, but I think there's just something that did not sit right with especially the conservative justices here, where you have state officials who tend to be quite politically liberal, who encouraged mass protests over the summer and, you know, for a very, let me be very clear, for a very good reason. And certainly whether or not you believe it was for a good reason, it is a fundamental First Amendment right to protest, to assemble, to speak.
Right.
So, you know, but I think there was something for these justices that didn't sit right with, you know, the, whether it be specifically Governor Cuomo or other state officials kind of encouraging that and vindicating those actions, which could be quite risky. And then being so strict when it comes to exercise of religion, which is no less a fundamental right than protest and speech. It is literally in the exact same amendment. So, you know, I don't think there's, I think there's something about it that just didn't sit right. And I think, you know, the restrictions are less than intellectually honest. And I think that's where it really went awry here.
I mean, as you know, I haven't kept this a secret. I attend church, and I was brought up with a mindset of you go every single week. And I've had some of my friends and family where if that church door is open, you better be, your butt better be there in that seat, or else you're probably going to hell. I mean, that might be just a slight exaggeration, hyperbole, but only a slight. I mean, it was pretty much that bad. And there are some other faiths I know in the Jewish tradition where it really is essential every single Sunday or Sabbath, you need to be in church. And so who gets to make the determination that going to church is not essential? Because to a lot of us, it is essential. And now I know I've been able to, my beliefs are such that I can also go to church via Zoom and I watch it, you know, it was live streamed and things like that. Other people, though, feel like they got to actually be there in person. I guess the point is, who gets to make that decision? Here's where I'm going, Mackenzie. I think there is such a thing as COVID fatigue. I just think we're tired of it. We've been under the gun for so long. And when we see people like Governor Gavin Newsom in California put these onerous restrictions on all these businesses, shut them down, and then he goes out and dines at a nice posh restaurant, it just makes us think that, all right, it's not that big of a deal. I thought it was, but now I think you're just flapping your jaws. Look, you're attending these restaurants. You don't even believe your own regulations. I'm not going to believe it. I'm going to just go out there and do my own thing. Do you think there's such a thing as COVID fatigue?
Well, absolutely. And what you describe is nothing short of an abject failure of leadership. I mean, that should be called out and condemned universally. It's completely ridiculous in order to be a good leader, an effective leader, you have to walk the walk. Like, it's basic leadership 101. I'm not the leader of anything except for my family. And I can tell you, if I'm a hypocrite when it comes to my kids, they notice immediately and they will just do whatever they want. Like, it's not rocket science. You have to walk the walk. And there are so many leaders who are just not doing it. And of course, I mean, it's been months and months and months. We're all exhausted. Yeah, there's definitely a fatigue. And I think that's part of the insidiousness of this disease. Like, there is enough cognitive dissonance to where people can say, well, you know, half of the time it's not even symptomatic, so it won't happen to me and I'll be okay. Right. And, you know, it's just like the smoker who smokes a pack a day and says, well, my grandmother's neighbor's cousin smoked a pack a day for 50 years and lived to be 100. Right. You know, it gives you an out cognitively to think like, well, you know, probably nothing will happen. And it's kind of, I guess, the problem of externalities. You know, you can do something and say, well, I'm not going to feel the consequence. But when we all think that way, when we all do it, we all kind of feel the consequence collectively.
And there is a disconnect. I looked at the numbers again this morning, and still it's about 1.9% of Americans will die who come down with COVID. But that's still only 1.9%. I'm not suggesting that's not a significant number. What I'm suggesting is that means there's over 98% that they're not dying. And so if they don't see the people dying, and it's been so long, then in their own mind, they start to think it's not that big of a deal. It's like the flu. I know for myself, now I'm not this dumb, but for myself, my family, three of us all came down with COVID. It was nothing more than a mild cold. In fact, if there wasn't a national pandemic, I wouldn't have even missed a single golf outing or a tennis match. It was that minor. My extended family, my brother and his family also, came down to it. Similar experience. So we see this, and we know from, I guess, what other people are saying that people are dying from. We know it's serious. I just wonder if that plays into it as well, that we just don't see it up close and personal. And so after a while, we develop a fatigue and a little bit of a callousness to it. I don't know. Maybe I'm off my rocker with that.
No, I think you're exactly on point. And it's funny with statistics and numbers like that, like how you can phrase it. I mean, if you say, you know, you have a 98.2% chance of surviving and coming through it okay, like that's one thing to a human brain. But if you say it's 19 times deadlier than the flu, which it is, you know, that kind of sits a different way. And I also think, unfortunately, and this is, you know, really sad, but I, you know, 250,000 Americans have died from this disease. If those people were children, politicians, you know, wealthy people, people with power and people with influence, like, we'd all be singing a different tune. And I think we need to look in the mirror and say, like, we are losing people, and we are not treating this like those people have equal dignity. And that is something that we need to really look at. It's very tragic.
Well, Mackenzie, speaking of COVID fatigue, I think that actually played a role in the court's decision in this case, because if you remember, wasn't that long ago, a very similar case reached the U.S. Supreme Court. I believe it dealt with Las Vegas or Nevada's restrictions and maybe California, some other restrictions. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision with Roberts, right, you know, being the swing vote, said that, yeah, these restrictions are okay, even though they seem to be discriminatory against churches. We're in the middle of a national pandemic. We don't want to be, as justices, right, 9 unelected officials, be determining the public's response in this national pandemic situation. All right, but we have a different court now. You have number
That's
one,
right,
Amy Coney Barrett's on the court, not RGB. But I think more importantly, it's now been a long time. And so, whereas in the beginning, we're willing to give them the benefit of the doubt because it's all new, now we're 9 months into this. We know a little bit better. We know these restrictions can be narrowly tailored. For in this case, I think what was most egregious were two things. But most importantly, there was one church that had a seating capacity of 2,500 people. All right. Why is it reasonable for that church to only be allowed to put in their 10 people?
Right.
I mean, they seat 2,500. Are you telling me they can't have more than 10 people in that church? Right. And that's crazy.
No, it reminds me. It actually reminds me of the Trump Muslim ban. The first one that got struck down. And in that case, the court said, like, this isn't even rationally related to what you're trying to do. Like, you're so overbroad in some areas and then you're under-inclusive in other areas. And it's just so off the mark. You're coloring so far outside the lines that we just really, like, we can't uphold this. And it's very similar. Like, this restriction was so poorly thought out and so poorly implemented that it really gave the Supreme Court, I feel like, an easy out. And look, you still had three justices dissenting, and, you know, it wasn't a unanimous decision.
Let me point out
what
you just said there. I don't want us to lose sight of what you just said, because some listeners might have been confused by our numbers there. You said three dissented. Roberts was an interesting one, because Roberts also dissented, so there would have been four, but for a different reason. Roberts said, look, the actual city changed its rules so that the plaintiffs in this case are no longer burdened. So it was like a last-minute change. And so Roberts said, we shouldn't even decide this on the merits. We should dismiss this as being moot, and so I would not have disturbed I would not have sided with the other five in majority. So actually, six justices decided, yes, this is bad. This does violate the First Amendment, but Roberts would not have granted the injunction because he said it's a moot matter at this point in the proceedings because they changed their rules. So a little bit of a technical maneuver there by the Chief Justice. All right, let's move on now to Edwards v. Vannoy, because I know, Mackenzie, later on, we're going to talk about a case near and dear to your heart, and I'm just going to tease it a little bit. I think it involves some Beverly Hills housewife. But again, yes, we're going to get there eventually.
R-H-O-B-H for aficionados like myself.
I have no idea what you're saying, but I assume you'll unpack it and embarrass me here in just a bit. But Edwards v. Vannoy first. This is a case at the Supreme Court this week, and it dealt with the retroapplicability of Supreme Court decisions. Now, I'm sure I just lost a lot of our listeners. Let me back up. All right. Last April, the Supreme Court, in a case called Ramos v. Louisiana, held that the Sixth Amendment requires unanimous jury verdicts in both federal and state criminal courts. So let's say you're going to trial. There's a, you know, Mackenzie, you as a prosecutor back in the day, you're prosecuting someone, you're going to throw them in jail. You would have to get 100% of the jurors to agree with you before you can throw someone in jail, right? That's the unanimous jury verdict requirement. Well, the Supreme Court held back in April that the Constitution requires, in both federal and state cases, unanimous verdicts. All right, so then the next issue in this case is, all right, well, there's people in jail today who were put in jail, right? They're experiencing the Shawshank experience, but they had less than unanimous verdicts. They had a couple people dissenting. And so do we let them just stay in jail? Do we retry them? Is this decision retroactive? So, Mackenzie, any thoughts on this case?
You know, I think we talked about the Ramos versus Louisiana case in a prior podcast, and it's a really fascinating case because when that first came out, I didn't even know that there were states where you didn't have to have a unanimous jury. You kind of like take it for granted. But apparently
that was my first response. It was a head scratcher. What? Yeah,
so
states that don't require
it. Exactly. And I feel like, you know, I don't know how this case is going to go, but I feel like when you, and I guess specifically in this case, the question is whether it's applicable retroactively to people who have exhausted their direct appeals, but not their collateral appeals.
Explain
on habeas corpus.
What you mean by that.
So,
because that is an issue to some of the justices, the whole habeas corpus issue.
Right. So, you know, and for people who have seen Legally Blonde, habeas corpus is a big issue in the law. So let's talk about it. So in criminal cases, you have like two sets of appeals. And that's why, I mean, if you're a fan of true crime or you've seen Making a Murderer or listen to the podcast Serial, some of these cases go on for years and years and years and years after the crime was allegedly committed. And the reason is because when you have a criminal trial and you're found guilty, you can appeal the verdict on any number of grounds. For example, the judge let in evidence that he shouldn't have let in, he or she should not have let in under the rules of evidence for whatever reason. And because of that, I need a new trial because the rules of evidence were violated. And that's what, you know, some of the justices at the Supreme Court were saying, we're not an error correcting court. That's the first appeal. You go to an error correcting court, which is usually an intermediate court that says, you know, either okay, you did, maybe you did violate the rules of evidence or maybe you didn't. And if the intermediate court says you didn't violate the rules of evidence, then you could appeal that to the highest court of typically the state for most crimes. It will be in a state court. And you could say, you know what, this rule of evidence actually, you know, maybe the trial judge didn't apply it in accordance with the rule, but the rule itself is unconstitutional. So I'm going to challenge that. So once you go up through that series of appeals and you lose, you get collateral appeals, which in some cases you can get a state habeas corpus and a federal habeas corpus, which are basically not saying that the rules of trial were improperly applied by the trial judge, but that some constitutional or fundamental right is violated by keeping you in prison or by having you, you know, still be incarcerated. All right, so McKenzie,
let me ask you something, because I know you have a lot more experience in the criminal aspect than I do, because I'm confused by that. You're saying after all your appeals are done, you've been convicted, you can file some other appeal in federal or state court under habeas corpus, arguing a constitutional violation. Why would you have not have made that argument the first time through? You know, if you're in court, the first, as a matter of first instance, why aren't you arguing your constitutional rights?
Well, it depends. So I don't have a ton of experience in this area, but I think sometimes, you know, you're not in the right court. So sometimes you have to go through the state courts before you can file a federal habeas petition, which is where you're saying, look, all the courts in my state, every government agency got it wrong. Everyone's violating my constitutional rights, and I need the federal courts to step in and correct this. Sometimes there's newly discovered evidence. So you can file a habeas petition that says, like, look, I may have been convicted under the evidence at the time, but now we have DNA and they've, you know, run the DNA on this. And it turns out, I shouldn't have been convicted. So I can file a habeas petition. So yeah, those are some examples. But again, I'm sure there are many more that I'm missing.
Okay. So they can file for habeas. And here in this particular situation, that some people would have exhausted their habeas remedies, some would not have. Now, the court also mentioned this distinction, and that is, when, you know, like in Ramos v. Louisiana, for example, since that's the issue here before the court, was the court just reaffirming an old rule, in which case you would have retro applicability of this rule, or is the court creating a newly recognized criminal procedural rule? If that's the case, it would not be retroactive. And so the issue is, here with unanimous jury verdicts, is this a rule that is, they're just reaffirming an old rule, or is this a newly recognized criminal procedural rule? And of course, one of the big issues, McKenzie, is the burden this will put on the criminal justice system. Because if you're going to talk about retrying all these people who are sitting in jail today with less than unanimous jury verdicts, that's going to be a lot of trial come Monday morning. I mean, these prosecutors are going to have a lot of work on their hands. You're just not going to open up the doors to the jail and let these people go. And so they also are going to consider the burden on the trial system. Any other thoughts on this Edwards v. Vannoy case?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting. I think most people probably think, you know, oh, well, the quote-unquote liberals probably are more in favor of the criminal defendant's rights. But actually, you know, in a case like this, it's very interesting because it shows you, you know, first you've got the issue of whether you're going to define the issue as one of being an activist court, you know, making new law, or just recognizing a right that's always been enshrined in the Sixth Amendment. And then you have, you know, whether to consider the practical real world implications of your ruling, which some justices would say, you know, you shouldn't do, and some would say you should. So I think it'll be really interesting. I mean, look, just personally, and I don't know how, you know, the legal analysis ties into this, but I have a hard time being okay with people sitting in jail for the rest of their lives, or, you know, God forbid, on death row with less than a unanimous jury verdict, when our highest court in the land has ruled that that is a violation of their constitutional rights. It just does not sit well with me. So,
right.
You know, I guess that's how I'm hoping it turns out, but we'll see.
You mentioned that this issue did create strange bedfellows. And so the original Ramos v. Louisiana case, three were in dissent. Those three were Roberts, Alito, and Kagan, which meant that Thomas and RBG and Sotomayor and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh would have been in the majority altogether. So it did create strange bedfellows whenever you get Roberts siding with RBG against, Thomas and RBG siding against Roberts and Kagan. It's kind of an odd situation. Well, after oral argument last week, it looks like Gorsuch, Sotomayor, and Breyer are the three justices that are tending to say yes. Based upon their questioning, it looks like they are going to be in favor of retroapplicability of this rule. And the question is, can they get two additional justices? So we'll have to wait. A decision is expected come June. All right, let's get to the second issue. I know you're just dying to talk about, McKenzie, election lawsuits. I know this fascinates you. Is there anything left to these lawsuits? Anything worth talking about today?
You know, I mean, talk about fatigue. This is another area where I just feel I have chronic fatigue, 2020 fatigue, and this is a big component of it. You know, I mean, I think we're now in the first week of December. We've got about 10 days left before the Electoral College meets and casts their votes. That's right. And so, you know, really the window is narrowing so much that you can't really even see light through it anymore. I think the thing from my perspective to mention is that the case we talked about last time in the Middle District of Pennsylvania was appealed to the Third Circuit. The district judge's ruling was affirmed vociferously, and the judge who wrote the opinion at the Third Circuit happened to be a Trump appointee. So again, I mean, it just kind of underscores the point that we were making last week, that there is still hope. People should not despair. The system can work, and in many instances does work. And there are, you know, I'm not going to speak personally about any judge, obviously, or really about, you know, how judges will rule in the future, but we've seen multiple instances of election officials, state actors, and judges putting, you know, the law before their party or maybe even their personal political inclinations. So I would say, like, chin up, everyone.
right.
There is still hope, and our system is still pretty good fundamentally.
Well, here are my two takes on the election lawsuits. So two are conservatives that listen to us. All right. Here is my message to them, because the liberals, they're still out partying. They don't even care. But to the conservatives, here is my message to them. All right. We love Attorney General Barr. He is so highly respected. What he did during the impeachment proceedings was so notable. He stood up to Mueller. He stood up to all of the media that was coming crashing down on him. I believe he did what was the right thing despite all the vicious criticism against him. We like Attorney General Barr. He's one of the people on the conservative side. We also like Fox News. We think Fox News does a lot of at least as equal conservative reporting as MSNBC does liberal reporting. All right. We like Fox News. And we like these judges who are in our Supreme Court justices who were put there, right? They don't find fraud. If fraud existed, these guys would be pointing it out. Now, when I say fraud, here's what I'm talking about. Wide-scale fraud necessary to overturn an election result. It's not enough, as we talked about last week, to say, oh, look, I saw one instance of fraud. Yeah. No, take that one and multiply it by 100,000. You need an awful lot of instances of fraud to overturn an election. And again, if Attorney General Barr is saying, I haven't seen it to that extent yet. If Fox News, you know, Sean Hannity, Tucker Carlson, they're not talking about it because there is nothing there to talk about. Again, I think it
there
is important.
There was no collusion.
That's right. Yeah,
exactly. That's another theme of 2020. No collusion. No one is smart enough or has enough energy to collude. Like, let's just leave it alone.
Yes. So don't despair. As you said, our system worked. But here is the real scary news. I don't know if it's scary or not. I guess I shouldn't say that because I know a lot of people think this is not scary. But here is what I think is actually going on. Trump is looking hard for examples of fraud, and he's going to find it, but he's going to run out of time. Now, I don't think it exists to the level unnecessary to undo the election. That's not going to matter to Trump. He's going to find his instances of fraud, and then he's going to say, look, I ran out of time, but this was not a valid election, and he's going to announce his candidacy for 2024 during Biden's inauguration. You heard it from me first. That is what is going to happen. And then 4 more years means 4 more years of Trump campaigning. And so I don't know what your thoughts are, if you have any thoughts on that, but I'll give you the last word.
I just blacked out for a second. I can't even just emotionally deal with that possibility. So let's just wait till January. If you're right, I will enroll for a support group and we will see what happens. I mean, look, I wouldn't put it past him. I think, you know, there's definitely a narrative being constructed in which he is the sole, you know, he alone can fix the broken electoral system. And I just, that type of cult of personality does frighten me. I mean, I don't think anybody, I'm a huge Barack Obama fan, but I don't think he, you know, is above anyone else or the law or is the end all be all. Like, he's fallible and made a lot of mistakes too. I don't like the fact that this kind of ambiance kind of surrounds Trump with a lot of people. So we'll see. I hope it doesn't happen. I hope he gets fatigue and just like wears himself out and goes to like,
oh, now you're
somewhere.
Being delusional. Now who's being delusional?
But no, we will just have to see.
I said I'd give you the last word, but I lied. And so here's my last word. I think Nikki Haley is positioning herself for a run. I think that she's already made public statements about what's going on in Georgia. She doesn't live in Georgia. She was the governor of South Carolina. Why is she opining on what is going on in Georgia? She is trying to stake a position as a leader of the Republican Party, eyeing a run in 2024. And so if Trump states his position, hey, I'm going to run, then who is going to then run against him? Because you know he's going to be attacking those Republicans as well. And so I think Nikki Haley is going to try to beat him to the punch. Let her put her position, stake her claim, try to be very involved with the Georgia election, and then we'll see what happens.
All right. I'm a much bigger fan of that than the alternative, so we'll
all
see.
Right, all right. Well, you know what? This is being recorded, so I'm going to replay this here in about 3 months to show how brilliant we were. All right, let's talk about the biggest legal issue from this last week involving someone named Erica Jane. Is that did I say that right?
I have no. That's her stage name.
I have no idea who that person is.
She,
you need to explain this for me because I am dumb. I got to tell you, I don't watch any reality TV series if there's not a football or basketball involved. So walk me through this lawsuit.
Football is like the guy, like, not to be too heteronormative, but like football is like the guy's version of reality TV. Like,
right.
So you're the large percentage of your brain that's like filled with all this like sports trivia knowledge and these statistics and all that, like that.
That's me.
In my head is knowing all of these Real Housewives and their interrelationships and their dating histories and all of that. But
so this involves Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. Just tell me a little bit about what this show is about.
Okay. Well, the show, it's not really about anything. The show is about a bunch of housewives in Beverly Hills. They have them in various cities throughout the country, but this version is in Beverly Hills, and they're
good titling.
Right. They're all married to, well, most of them are married to like really rich men, and they just
okay.
kind of have cocktails in the middle of the day and get in fights with each other and go shopping. And then every season they take a vacation to some luxurious destination where they embarrass themselves by drinking in the middle of the day and fighting.
Wow, that's a show.
Going shopping. So that's pretty much, you know.
We can't,
it's
we got to come up with our own
show. You can, yeah, you can be multitasking. Like, so I like to watch it while either I'm exercising or folding laundry.
Right.
To kind of pass the time. So that's like the type of show it is. But there is a Real Housewife of Beverly Hills.
So can I ask a question here without sounding too stupid?
Sure.
Because you sent me some links today, and I watched some of these Housewives shows. It seems like all of their lips are really big. Is that just me being off, or what's going on there?
They may have indulged in some light filler and facial work.
How often would you have to do that? I have no idea.
I have no idea. I don't know. Like, lawyers don't have to do that. So,
okay.
You know, I don't know, but I can tell you that they're probably not 100% natural.
They weren't born that way. Okay.
They were not born that way. So,
those are not God-given. All right.
Correct. Yeah, so there's a Real Housewife of Beverly Hills named Erica Jane, and her legal name is Erica Girardi, and she's married to Tom Girardi, who was one of the plaintiff's attorneys, I believe, involved in the Aaron Brockovich litigation. He did
yes,
toxic torts for a while.
I looked that up. He
yeah,
actually was
think,
the lawyer.
Yes.
I think he was the lawyer depicted in Aaron Brockovich, which I find fascinating because, I mean, he won, what, millions and millions of dollars, and I'm not sure the guy in Aaron Brockovich was portrayed as that rich, but nonetheless, apparently that's that lawyer.
Yeah, and he got extremely rich from doing that, and I think a couple other toxic tort cases. So he's very well known, I guess, and, you know, he's older now. I think he's, you know, 20 or 25 years older than
81. 81.
Erica Jane. Yeah, so he's 81. Erica Jane is probably, you know, in her mid-40s, maybe. So there's a very big age difference.
Right.
But apparently they fell in love, and they've been married for 20 years. And I started getting involved in this story because it came out a couple weeks ago that they were getting a divorce. And if you watch the show, that would be very shocking to you because they seem to be very much in love and have a good relationship. And it's kind of sweet on the show. It's actually seems like one of the more genuine aspects
of the
show. So
this came as a surprise to you.
It came as a surprise. And then what makes it less surprising is now there has been a lawsuit filed against both of them by another plaintiff's firm who, I guess, in conjunction with Tom Girardi, represented a class of plaintiffs in the Lion Air litigation, which was one of the Boeing 737 MAX crashes against Boeing. And they got settlements that are, it's a confidential settlement, but it's worth millions of dollars. And apparently the allegation, the allegation is that Tom Girardi has been embezzling client funds from this settlement and who knows what else to fund Erica Jane's lavish lifestyle on the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, and that they are getting a divorce as a sham to hide assets for like from the creditors and the plaintiffs in these lawsuits. I mean, it is shocking. And I really feel like everyone should be following this.
Well, you know what? We are going to follow this. I teach a class, as you know, a lawyer for lawyers. I do a wacky case review, the most fascinating headline cases, and we analyze what is the law behind the headlines. And all of a sudden, I have a ton of issues here. So obviously, if he's taking clients' money, settlements, and directing them to himself or whatever, that's horrible. I mean, he's going to be disbarred for that. You can't do that. So you're assuming there's something else going on here. I'm not sure what that something else would be, because if he is really siphoning off client funds and then taking them for himself, he's out of money. I mean, he's in dire straits. And
that's horrible.
Right. Is he really? Is someone who won a class action lawsuit of $460 million. Has he blown through all that money? I mean, I find that hard to believe.
I mean, you got to watch the show. Like, there's a lot of private jets involved. And look, I'm in the aviation industry, and I can tell you those things are not cheap. So
right.
I don't know. And I guess, you know, the bottom line and the moral of the story is mo money, mo problems. When you start spending it, then you have to keep making it. And
Second here, Mackenzie. What if I'm thinking about this the wrong way? They're not trying to hide his money because he's out of money. They're trying to hide her, protect her money, because if they were married, could they not then get their marital assets? Is that a possibility, or am I off there?
Maybe. I mean, I don't know what the law is in California with respect to that. So it's very interesting. Maybe that's what they are trying to do. Although I did hear that she was asking for... Maybe this is another celebrity. I could be wrong about this, but I think I heard that she was asking for like $500,000 a month in child support or not child support, okay. In spousal support. So you know what? That might have been another celebrity who said they needed it to take care of their kids, which.
Well, this is a fascinating case. We definitely have to keep following this. And Mackenzie, is this all right if I task you with keeping up on this and keeping me in the loop? I want to know from watching the show, how are they treating the storyline? Because I don't see the legal rationale here. Because if he's siphoning off money, he's in a world of hurt. He's flat broke. And so if they're trying to protect, she surely is making money from her job.
On Broadway. Yeah. She was, in Chicago on Broadway, and she's, you know, on the show. So she definitely makes not hundreds of millions of dollars by any stretch, but she makes a million dollars. Yeah, sure.
And so as a husband and being married for 20 years, I mean, he'd be entitled to some of that eventually. I don't know. So maybe they're just saying we're going to split that so there's no connection between the two. So we're going to follow this and keep you updated because I got to know what the answer is. And I'm probably going to watch the show in the interim. Somehow I'll find a way to do that so it can't be traced to me. So
Sounds good.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And we'll come back next week as we unpack the wild, crazy world of law. And maybe by next week, well, definitely by next week, the Electoral College, well, it'll be set. They have to set the electors here by, I believe, it's the 8th of December. All the states have to get their stuff lined up, their ducks in a row, and then they're going to meet and vote on the 14th of December. So, all right. We'll talk to you next week, Mackenzie. Have a great week.
Sounds good. You too.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a mess, Sean Wynn, and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do, Brooke Bolin for spreading the good word about us, and Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.